You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas behind your favorite online brands. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Aishwarya Iyer, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You're the founder of Brightland. It's a new, modern olive oil company. You're making olive oil from California
olives? That's right.
You launched when?
June of 2018, so basically a year ago.
Wow, that's crazy. It's only been a year.
Yes.
Time moves quickly. So let's talk about how you got interested in starting an olive oil company in 2018. Olive oil has been around for like 5,000 years.
Yes, it has. It's one of the original superfoods.
And olive oil is one of the foods that's the most adulterated, fraudulent areas that people might not know about. Give us some background on what's going on in the olive oil industry and why you set out to try and change things.
So I guess it makes sense to start from a little bit of the beginning. I'm from Texas and I moved to New York to go to school. I went to NYU, to the Gallatin School of Individualized Study, which is a really special program within the school. And then I was working at L'Oreal in the luxury products division at Lancôme. So I think like a kind of luxury CPG chip kind of lodged in my brain at the time and I didn't realize it. And then I made a little bit of a career pivot and went to a finance technology company called Second Market and was doing public affairs, a lot of PR, a lot of marketing. And I was there for, I think, about 4 years. But in any case, I'm like living this New York life of never cooking. And, you know, the way that I grew up in an immigrant household. You know, I'm Indian. And my parents were just dead set on eating at home every night. I think one, as a way to like preserve culture and tradition. And it was nostalgic for them to cook and they wanted to kind of preserve that for us. So grew up eating at home all the time, never ate outside. And then I think moving to New York, I was sort of like, wow, I have these, you know, thousands of restaurants to my disposal. So I made this like huge spreadsheet and was like,
wait, what?
Yeah, I had a spreadsheet. I still have
of, like,
it
restaurants?
Of like 800 plus restaurants
that you wanted to go.
Wanted to go to, went to. And then I would like write little notes about what I thought about them. So that way I was like the person in my friend group to kind of refer people out to, you know what, you should go here if you have friends coming in.
Right. Then why not Yelp or Foursquare or something?
Because I had my very specific thoughts on, you know,
got it.
This is why. Yeah, I don't know.
No, it makes sense.
Crazy. But yeah. So I was just bopping around the city doing that. And then around year 8 of living in New York, I was like, okay, maybe it's time to like start cooking. And I had an apartment where there was like a little more of a kitchen and got into a relationship. And so both my partner and I started cooking. And one thing that we both noticed was that we kept getting these stomach aches. And at first we were like, oh, it must be the bread. You know, everybody's kind of gluten-free now. So we like cut out bread. And then we thought, oh, maybe it's, you know, the cheese. So we stopped eating cheese for a little while and we kept kind of eliminating things from our diet. And eventually the only constant that was left was the olive oil. And until then, like I had never given olive oil a second thought. And, you know, I did a little bit of research and this was, you know, to put a timestamp on it, this was like early 2015. And that's when I learned that a lot of the olive oil that Americans are consuming and people around the world are consuming is rotten, rancid, or adulterated. And what adulterated means is that it's been blended with palm oil or canola oil. Mm-hmm. And what rotten and rancid means is that, you know, it could be old, it could be made with moldy olives. There's this term in the olive oil industry called grubby, which means that flies fly in and lay eggs, and then they still make olive oil with that. So all of these kinds of instances could be happening, and that's the olive oil that, you know, is being served and being consumed by millions and millions of people.
I forget if it was like Cook's Illustrated or someone did tried to like look into all the major olive oils you can buy in stores in the US, and it was just like a very small proportion that were truly extra virgin, because there's also the notion that extra virgin as opposed to regular olive oil, what's the difference? It's like the first pressing, right, is the extra virgin? Okay, go
ahead. There are different grades. So you have extra virgin, then you have virgin, and then you have, you could call it like pure or light, or ultimately it's like considered lamp oil in, you know, in ancient sort of Greek and Roman times. They were using it to light lamps, but that's a lot of the oil that people are actually eating now. It starts from every piece of the kind of process. So it could be the olives are picked in a certain way at a certain time of the year. They are not thrown onto the ground and then picked up. And then like, how clean is your mill? What is the milling process? What is the storage process? Then ultimately, what's the bottling process? So all of those things, kind of like dominoes, have to fall in a certain way for it to then be considered extra virgin grade. And so you get evaluated via a chemical analysis and a sensory kind of evaluation to determine whether your olive oil is extra virgin grade.
So you had these stomach problems. And is that a thing that if you look that up, people are having stomach problems because
it's
of bad
funny.
Olive oil?
It's funny. I've talked to a lot of like nutritionists and folks in food and people are like, absolutely, it's a thing. Because if it's rancid or rotten olive oil, there could be like mycotoxins and all kinds of things going on. So yeah, it could be something that is affecting your stomach.
But it's still a leap to go from that to like, I want to start an olive oil company.
So what was like the in between? Yeah. So 60 Minutes had done a piece about how the Italian mafia is really involved with olive oil fraud. And I thought that was so like wild and crazy and super interesting. And so I started asking friends like, oh, you know, do you use olive oil? And everyone's like, yeah, of course, you know, it's a no brainer. And then I'm like, cool. Did you know that this kind of exists, you know, this fraud? And everyone's like, that's really gross. Like, I didn't know that. And then I was like, okay, so what brand are you using? And people just couldn't tell me what they were using and they didn't really know. And I felt like there was no affinity in any way. And, you know, I took a step back and thought about, you know, should I create like the seal of approval? Like at first, that's what I thought I would do. Like maybe it's like, you know, tested and tried, and maybe it's like a certification program, like, and we bring, you know, olive oil from around the world. And I started digging more into kind of the Italian olive oil industry, which is, you know, the biggest industry in the world, and found that most of the olive oil coming from Italy isn't actually from Italy. Like a lot of times the olives are pressed and milled in Spain or Tunisia or Greece or even Georgia, the country. Just there's a lot happening that we have no idea about in terms of like building a traceable supply chain. So, you know, I kind of was like overwhelmed by that kind of concept of, okay, then I'd have to find the solution. So in any case, you know, I moved to LA and a couple of friends were telling me that there's amazing olive oil here in California. And I started visiting farms here just out of, you know, intrigue and interest. And I was just so blown away by how gorgeous the olive oil was here and how, you know, there's a really like incredible, fast-growing kind of community and just in terms of like growth within the domestic production of olive oil, like it's happening and the time is kind of now. So it felt like a really exciting time, kind of like how, you know, California winemakers talk about in the, you know, 70s and 80s, it was the time then, even though the rest of the world kind of laughed and said, oh, what can California bring to the table from a, like, you know, really amazing wine standpoint? I felt like there was something really special, like from a timing standpoint here with olive oil. For a little while, I really felt like it wasn't my story to tell. Like I didn't come from a food background at all. I'm not some like famous chef. So I had this like feeling of, you know, I think someone else is going to do it. I don't know if it's my journey to go on. And I'm not one of those people who's like, and then I saw the business and thought that it was a good opportunity. Like that's just not the way that I want to build my life and really build, you know, products or things that I care about. And so I was like, I don't know if this is for me, like my journey. You know, I was talking to my grandparents and just they were telling me a little bit about our ancestors. And they were like, you know, you come from a line of like salt farmers in the 1800s in South India, and they used to harvest the sea like for salt. And that was the business they had. And it was a massive business.
Wow.
And I don't know, but that really kind of clicked in place a little bit of like, wow, I had to know a little bit about where I was going to know, you know what, this could be a journey that I could go on. And I had to understand that we had such a close connection to the land and to food in that kind of meaningful way. That combined with, you know, every farm that I visited, I had this list of 40 farms and I was visiting these farms on the weekends, and every farm that I visited, they would tell me about, you know, their brand and distribution. And I felt like there was a little bit of a disconnect with mm-hmm. kind of what was happening generally. And those things kind of came together. And that's when, you know, I think this was late 2016, early 2017 that I said, you know what, I'm going to do this.
And this is something I don't know, but how much variability is there in all of...
like varietals?
Not varietals, but like you compared it to wine, but you know, from one growing season to the next, like I'm assuming that with a lot of, you know, the more commercial brands, there's a lot of blending going on yep. to try to create a very consistent product. Is that something where when you were starting to look at the farms, was that a consideration for you where you were going to be, I'm just going to have to be okay with a certain amount of variability yes. in the product and that kind of stuff?
Oh, absolutely. It was something that I grappled with, to be honest, because, you know, I was like, after every harvest, people are going to get used to, you know, it tasting a certain way. And if it changes even a little bit, what are people going to think? But I think that's the beauty of it, that yeah. we are, you know, chasing the sun in our own way. And it's the most like kind of pure, beautiful thing, right? Like it's ultimately from the land. We're not adding additives or preservatives or mixing it up with a co-packer. Like it's just so...
It's funny that it's not olive oil is not sold like by the year, like wine almost, you know?
Well, it is. It with is. Brightland, it is.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the one that, you know, I've shared with you yeah. is harvested in November of 2018.
So the olive oil that I buy, I've gotten through this company called Especially Puglia. It's a weird little company. They were set up through Kickstarter, and I've just really enjoyed their olive oil. I buy it in like really big like amounts, but it's kind of like that. So it's like you sponsor a tree, I guess. I don't really know all the details, mm-hmm. but because it's always harvested in the fall, or how does that work?
It depends on where you are in the world, but yeah. in California, harvest begins in October and goes until January.
Right.
And for Brightland, our partner farm, we decide to harvest in the beginning of November. So it's all early harvest. And, you know, one quick kind of note back to what you were saying about the varietals or sort of the change between our first harvest, which, you know, we launched the company in June of 2018. So we were working with olives that were harvested in fall of 2017. Between that time to then this most recent harvest, California went through kind of a little bit of a climate change situation where the olives in February of 2018, they decided to start sprouting or kind of like, you know, growing because they were like, okay, you know, it's getting warmer. And then there was a freeze and then they all kind of shriveled up and shrunk back. So in terms of volume, there was a lot less olive oil to around the state. Just
wow,
that was just a thing. So we had to actually articulate to the entire kind of Brightland community and everyone, all of our customers, that we were going to switch kind of all of our idols for this year. And, you know, I was really nervous about it. And it was funny. A couple people were like, why are you even saying anything? Nobody's going to know. But that's just not those aren't the principles that, you know, the reason why I started this. So, you know, we articulated it. And if anything, like, we actually had one of our best days, like, you know, sales days, because we were very heartfelt and kind of open.
You were talking about a lot of the olive oil being rancid. What is like the proper shelf life of olive oil? You know, it seems like oxygen has a big impact on it. Yeah. Like how long does a normal like bottle of olive oil stay good?
Olive oil's biggest enemies are light, air, and heat. So part of the reason why, you know, if you know what Brightland's bottles look like, they are matte white. You know, it's all pretty and fine, but it's actually a UV protected powder coating on them that protects it from light because a lot of the olive oil that you see, you know, people are like, oh, you know, you want it in this clear container because that way you can see the oil, but it's going to go rancid in like a week if you kind of keep it in there.
Right.
That's, you know, one side of it. So unopened from the time of harvest, it's around 16 to 18 months. Mm-hmm. And if once you've opened it, you should probably, you know, consume a bottle within a quarter, like 3 to 4 months-ish.
Yeah. And I think most people who just have a bottle laying around like yeah. are not, or, you know, in terms of the stuff that you buy at the store, it's really hard to tell how
you don't
long
know when
it
was made. Yeah. That's right. And so like, you know, there have been folks who have done studies around figuring out when some supermarket brands, when they were actually made, and they were made 4 years ago.
Right.
And then they have another 2 years out. So those olive oils are just rotten.
I mean, it's like any fresh product, but it's not sold like a fresh product. Like it's like you're buying, you know, Folgers coffee or whatever.
Yes. And that's where it's the opposite of wine as well, because, you know, with wine, you can be like, oh, and then I'm going to save this for a decade. Mm-hmm. And with olive oil, you should not do that. No matter how expensive or special a bottle is, you should live in the moment and eat it.
Be here now. Okay, you were talking about grubbiness, all these different things. Like when you went to the producers and the farms and you were trying to like work with them, were they like receptive to what you were talking about? Were any of them selling under their own name, or were they mostly working with like bigger distributors and producers and trying to get stuff blended? Like how receptive were people when you went to them?
I think that people thought that I was just some random lady or girl like showing up, and I don't think people took me seriously at all.
Right.
Yeah, but I used that to my advantage because then I just asked a lot of questions and learned a ton. And in the process, it also serves as a great filter for who you want to go into business with and who you really want to partner with. Because if somebody's going to, you know, sort of write you off, that's probably not someone that you want to have a long-term relationship with in any way. So it actually served as a great kind of starting point of filtering through who I'd want to potentially work with. And then I took a course at the UC Davis Olive Center around kind of the evaluation of olive oil. And that was a really great course to understand what are the quality indicators that are really important to determine who that farm partner could be. So like, how important is it that they have a mill on site? How important is it that they, you know, are certified organic versus not being organic? And yeah, it was a great kind of starting point for me to then make that decision.
And when you were thinking about the person who would buy this, and were you thinking about yourself like back in New York, or is it important for you to have like famous chefs using it, or is it like the millennial consumer, like a lot of, you know, direct to consumer and, you know, internet brands are targeting these days? Or like, who do you think of as the person that you're trying to make this for?
I was really excited about the person who is at home, wants to really enjoy being at home rather than saying, you know what, I'm like super wanderlusty and I'm just going to constantly travel all the time and I'm going to have my away bag. Like, I think there's, you know, plenty of products and services and brands that are being built for folks like that. But for Brightland, I felt like, you know, for us, our entire ethos is around finding special, like everyday moments and making those really, you know, kind of bright and special. So For me, it's all about the people who are like looking around at their home and being like, you know, I just want to add something like a little unique or a little special for my home and, you know, elevate the everyday. That would be like the core consumer. So it could be someone who's in Chicago doing that. It could be somebody in New York looking around at their apartment doing that. And I think what's been exciting is that, you know, since launch, like we've shipped to 49 states, and some of our most like excited customers who are subscribers, they don't live on the coasts. They live in the center of the country.
And you were talking about affinity. You were saying that no one seemed to really remember what brand of olive oil they were buying. What, when you set out to like kind of create a name and a label and a brand around this product, what were the things that you were trying to do?
I wanted to bring emotion and intention and mood into a category that had never seen that. Food is so emotional, and you come home from work and or wherever and you're like, oh my God, I had this like horrible day. I just want a glass of wine and maybe like a big bowl of pasta, or wow, it's really cold outside and I want to be cozy. Like you just assign emotions, right? Around every food and around how you feel and what you want to do and what you want to make in the kitchen. And I felt like this foundation of our food didn't have any emotion or kind of emotional association tied to it. So that was the reason why we launched with two hero products, one for cozy days and slow nights, and the other for sort of the days where you feel like making salads and dressings and marinades. So that way you can really understand and check in with yourself quickly too, and then proceed into kind of like that ritual of cooking.
The way you're describing it reminds me, and I hope this will come across as a compliment, but have you ever read Blue Ocean Strategy? It's like a business book. I think it's actually a pretty good business book as far as those go, but one of the case studies they talk about is Yellowtail wine, which came out in the early 2000s, I think, and I mean, it's different in the sense that they're like targeting a much lower price point, I think, relative to the industry than you are. But a similarity was that before Yellowtail, the consumption of wine in the US was much lower, like less than half of what it is today. And they were trying to design a wine that would be for beer drinkers. Like they were trying to design a brand and a style and a product that would appeal to America's like biggest, you know, alcohol consumer, which is the beer drinkers. And what they were looking at was that almost every other wine on the market has, you know, a picture of a castle on the front and is really describing all of these like fancy qualities and trying to intimidate you almost with how much they're describing the terroir and all that kind of stuff. And they were trying to approach it more emotionally, like, you know, this is going to be, you know, more juicy, or like in simplifying the whole thing, not focusing so much on like the actual grape varietal. So I, the way that you're describing Brightland sort of reminds me of that, where it's focusing the customer on something different. I mean, it really worked well for Yellowtail. It's a, you know, very different type of, I think, like where they sit in the market, because your olive oil is like a little bit more premium in terms of relative to like the price point of the products that you might find just like off the shelf, right?
Yeah.
Does that resonate with you at all, like the way that they try to approach the market?
Yeah, I love hearing that, you know, whenever somebody tries to shake things up, or whenever somebody has like a clear vision of who their kind of consumer or customer is, that's amazing. Like, you know, coming from kind of marketing and PR, I was always telling any company that I worked at or any client that I had, like, you should never be everything to everyone. And I think a lot of companies and startups especially think they're everything to everyone. Like, I've had people come to me being like, oh, I see that Brightland's at Goop. Like, we really want to be in Goop. And I know that they're also, you know, gunning for Walmart. Like, that's just not going to work, you know, to be honest.
Yeah.
And you need to know who your customer is. And eventually, you know, maybe one can become a lot of things to many people, but that takes time. So, yeah.
You've been associated and sort of like lumped into a lot of the things that are going on right now with direct-to-consumer brands, but you've sort of explicitly decided like it's not DTC olive oil. It's broader than that. Do you think that like we're in a moment right now where there's just like almost on a monthly or weekly basis, like new brands that are taking this business model and trying to apply it to a new category? Has that helped you or hurt you or indifferent, or how do you feel about that relative to like Brightland as a like the Warby Parker of olive oil or something? Does that bother you?
No, I mean, I'm not that distracted by it. I think it's a very noisy time, to be honest. And so, yeah, but I'm not that distracted by it. You know, we haven't raised funding. We are doing things very differently in that, you know, from the get-go, I knew that retail was going to be a part of our strategy. So I wasn't sitting there being like, everyone's just going to buy olive oil online and through us, and then we're going to have Brightland stores. And, you know, that's fine and well, but I also understand that consumers want to experience the product in real life. And I think retail is severely underrated. And now in the last 12 months, we've seen all these brands suddenly start talking about how retail is great again and how they want to be an omni-channel brand. And I think it's a little funny, but yeah, to each their own.
You had some experience in venture capital and startups before Brightland. Did that inform your decision to not raise money for it?
Yeah, it definitely did. And I think, you know, for me, I really wanted to prove product market fit first. I really wanted to build something in a really lean way. I think a lot of companies are extremely bloated and they spend a lot of money when they don't necessarily need to. And so I wanted to see how far we could get without raising money.
But it's something that maybe down the road, like you would consider, or what are the indicators that you're looking at, regardless of whether you want to raise in the future, that tell you like you're on the right track? I mean, it seems like you're on your way there, that
yeah,
you're getting really positive response already.
Yeah, I think it's just going to be, you know, who the partners are and what we need at that time.
Where do you see the product line going from here? You have three different SKUs. You introduced a flavored olive oil with lemon.
Yep.
Do you see yourself going into other varietals more, or other blends, or other like flavored oils, or something completely different altogether?
Yeah. I mean, kind of the big picture is, and what, you know, we're really, our mission is to really be the Aesop of the kitchen. So, you know, if you know the brand Aesop, they have done a spectacular job of building out a beautiful product portfolio. And so I think there's a massive opportunity to do that with some forgotten pantry staples. But for now, you know, again, being kind of self-funded, like I'm not on some crazy time, you know, ticking time bomb of any kind. So I think the companies that are going to be around for a really long time understand that you have to take time to build things. So for now, in the summer, we're actually going to be introducing another olive oil. We just launched something with Sweetgreen. And so we have some more collaborations in the works that I'm excited to talk about later.
But not right now.
Not right now.
What, okay, let's talk about the practical nature of actually bootstrapping and getting your product off the ground, because there's a hairy like time when you're trying to go to the producers and say like, hey, I'm going to buy some of this product. Did you have a pre-order campaign, or how did you manage that period of time where you have to buy and make inventory? Yeah. You have to figure out how to get that initial wave of customers. How did you figure that part out?
So, you know, I had worked for over a decade and I have a partner, so I'm privileged to have support in that way. So the two of us decided to put some money into the business. So, you know, I want to be clear that, you know, I think this piece is very obscure in a lot of cases. You know, what does self-funding or bootstrapping mean? Sometimes for entrepreneurs, it's like they had an exit and then they take $2 million and put that in. And for others, it's they had nothing. Some people have wealthy relatives. For us, that's how we did it. So I took a step back and, you know, my background in comms and PR and marketing, I understood that PR is very critical when launching a company. So I knew that that was something that I was going to invest in no matter what. On the product side, you know, we ordered as much as we could with the kind of capital that we had. And then we decided to see how it went. And we sold through our first kind of batch of inventory in 3 days. And then we were like, okay, then we got to order more. And that was that.
How many people is Breitland today in terms of full-time folks?
So we have 2 full-time,
okay,
including me.
Wow.
And then we have 8 part-time.
So that is really lean. And it's about kind of what do you choose to do yourself versus what do you choose to partner with people on or outsource or contract? How do you think about that decision? What are the
time,
things you... Yeah.
Time and then things that I don't enjoy.
Okay.
So
like what?
Well, right now I'm actually hiring for an operations and supply chain manager. So if anyone's listening and wants to connect, please. So there's certain, you know, kind of areas of the business where, you know, I've been spearheading that and it's been great because, you know, I think it's important for a founder to understand their business through and through. So that's all fine, but we're getting to a point where I would love some additional support and expertise from people who really are like excellent at what they do. And then there are certain pieces, like in the beginning, I was doing our social, our Instagram, and Instagram, for anyone who has managed their own brand's Instagram can completely probably relate to this, like that it is so all-encompassing and so time-consuming.
Yeah.
I have so much respect for social media people who are doing it all day because it is such a beast to
kind of... I mean, it's very emotional just dealing with, you know, comments and people, messages
comments,
and all that kind of stuff.
Then there's the community, like you're, you know, kind of commenting on other people's and kind of being present. And then there's creating content.
Right.
It's time consuming and to create quality content. And that was something, you know, with Breitland, I knew we had such a huge opportunity because there are no olive oil brands and no kind of brands that are even similar to ours that are creating quality content in any way. So yeah, I was doing it for a couple of months and then realized how many hours I was spending. And so now we have 2 talented, very talented people who do it.
Where did the aesthetic behind Breitland come from? Because it's just very fun and beautiful. The photography is amazing. Photographing food in general is super challenging.
Yeah.
What did you learn about that and what were your inspirations?
So inspirations were kind of the phrase that life is a beautiful mess. Uh-huh. And that's really like our brand photography just symbolizes that through and through. So life is a beautiful mess. And then very inspired by New York, Paris, India, and California. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the mixture of those things. And then from a color palette standpoint, I knew that I didn't want green anywhere on the bottle anywhere near it. And I wanted green to speak for itself with the oil and the taste rather than we're going to just shove green everywhere in our brand. And so then when I took a step back and thought about, you know, what are the colors that I really want to celebrate? You know, when you go to a farmer's market, you see like squash blossoms and you see purple cauliflower. And mm-hmm. that is what eventually I wanted a lot of the farmer's market colors, tomato to shine through, blueberry. And so that's our palette.
What you're saying reminds me, it's like the first piece of advice that really stuck with me when I started doing graphic design stuff about like 20 years ago. I forget the context of it, but someone said like a car company would never have a car as its logo. But you see that all the time in the world of food that, you know, like if you go and look at olive oil labels, like
they have olives on them.
They have olives on them. They're yep. green. They're like, and maybe, you know, it's the simplest thing that comes across, but I think maybe that's where what you were saying about affinity and brand hasn't really come across.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think it's been really amazing to see, you know, like a year later, we've had thousands of customers post on Instagram how excited they are to receive the bottle, how excited they are that it's a part of their home. We get emails all the time from people saying like, it's a part of my self-care routine. We purposefully designed the bottle in the way that it looks for retail too. So not mm-hmm. only, you know, direct to consumer / social, you know, when people receive it at home, but also when people go to a store. So, you know, we did a test with Neiman Marcus and we're about to launch within 35 Neiman Marcus stores around the country. And one piece of feedback we got was that this bottle stands out amongst everything else in their kind of Epicure food home section.
What? How did you go about choosing the color of the bottle and, you know, the glass and all that kind of stuff and the powder coating? I mean, it's very specific.
I knew it, I wanted it to be white. I don't really remember why, but I knew I wanted it to be white. And then the bottle, you know, I had dozens of bottles in my home at one point and
wow.
was doing actually pour tests. So I would hold the bottle in my hand. I would have my partner hold the bottle in his hand and then had like a couple of friends who have different sized hands pour it to see, you know, if it like kind of glugged out or if it was like a slow pour, how people felt. Like there were some bottles that I got that were really stunning, but you had to use both hands and that's weird and not efficient.
Because they were so,
they were like wide
or,
and yeah.
Oh, I see.
But really gorgeous, you know.
Wow.
And so we did a lot of, yeah, testing like that. And then from a taste standpoint, I had around 40 people over the course of 2 or 3 months come to my house and do blind taste tests. So I'd have them try supermarket olive oil versus 3 of the kind of final farms we were choosing between. And the farm we ended up going with kept coming in first. Hmm. And people didn't know what they were, you know, they had no context.
When you think about some of the collaborations you've started, like Sweet Green, and you mentioned selling at Goop. I saw it on Huckberry, I think, also.
Yep.
How do you decide who you think would be a good partner for you?
Yeah, those are all names that I had listed before the brand even had a name.
Mm.
So I created this like brand document of sort of the brand's personality and our ideal consumers and what they're reading and what music they're listening to and our kind of brand, I don't know if you want to call it like purpose or promise, and also included like dream sort of collaborations or, you know, kind of places that we want the brand to be. So, you know, when I think about like Goop or Huckberry, they themselves as brands have just done a tremendous job of cultivating the right kind of content and building, you know, whether they have retail or sort of experiences out in such a really compelling, beautiful way. So for us, we're just so like honored to be a part of that. Hmm. And that's sort of what we want to see. We want to see retailers or makers or brands that are just pushing the envelope in terms of how they're thinking about their audience and community.
You talked about Aesop, and when I think of them as a brand, I really think about the retail stores,
because
they've done such an amazing job, and they, I don't even really know the details of this, but I read an article a while back that they choose architects and interior designers for every different, yes. every store is different.
Yes. Like the materials are different.
Right. But yeah. somehow there's an aesthetic that comes together.
Exactly.
And when you think like about that aesthetic, and you explicitly said you probably like starting a Brightland store is not like the top priority, but I'm just wondering,
but eventually,
like, yeah, what would that place be like?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I've thought about this a lot. Yeah. I mean, I really see it being like taking the kitchen and making it a real life scenario. And, you know, we need to have a lot more products before we kind of debut a store like that. But I just see it like basically a kitchen come to life. Yeah,
because they do a good job of creating like the environment sort of
yep.
It's not a you're not going to in a bathroom,
but
exactly,
kind of,
but
are.
You're kind of imagining what it might be like to be.
And they have a sink there that you can like experience
the
products in. And yeah, I think there's a huge opportunity for Brightland to do something like that.
I think the first time I met you, you was at a dinner and you were doing tastings around LA. And
yes.
I was asking you about what you were giving people to taste it with. And I was just assuming that it would be bread. But you said like, no, we don't have bread at our tastings. Is that still true, or am
it
I misremembering?
True. Yeah.
How does that work?
It's true. We're doing an event at The Wing on Monday, actually. And we're going to have cheese and chocolate.
You're like dipping the olive oil in chocolate, or
you drizzle the olive oil over dates or chocolate or cheese, and it
on
just,
cheese I've done that for
it's
sure.
It's so outstanding.
Because
I mean, again, like bread is nice and fine, but why not take
you're talking
other...
to a French guy who I love bread so,
so
much.
So do but I. Yeah. I mean, I love bread, but why don't we take other really delicious things and layer the oil on top?
I think it's really fascinating, and it creates a very different experience. I remember when I was like a broke college kid going to Whole Foods for the first time, and just, they don't do this as much now, but they would really let you sample a lot more than they do today. Like about, and you could, in the olive oil section, like you could try a lot of stuff, and they had bread out always. You could pretty much have a full meal just going to Whole Foods.
I think one of the best things that you can do with Brightland is take some dates and then pour Brightland over it and let it marinate for, I don't know, 3 to 4 hours, and then add some sea salt and just serve it on a platter for, you know, folks for a breakfast party or a dinner party. Everybody's really sort of blown away, and it looks really gorgeous, and it tastes incredibly like luscious and decadent.
What else have you been making with your olive oil lately?
I have a sweet tooth, so I love making like olive oil cakes. I made olive oil muffins recently.
Wow.
I love adding olive oil to ice cream. So like we have the Sicilian pistachio ice cream, and then I'll drizzle Brightland on top, add a little bit of sea salt, and maybe even some like cayenne pepper for like a little bit of a kick. We got this like some daily harvest samples from a neighbor. So we've been taking the smoothies and adding some olive oil to that.
Wow.
And that's been really, really tasty. And yeah, you're adding just like, you know, a boost of antioxidants and kind of a boost of health.
Yeah, I had olive oil ice cream for the first time recently. There's a Salt and Straw down the street here, and they make ice cream that's just like very basic. It's just olive oil. A lot of their flavors are kind of surprising or shocking or combinations that you wouldn't expect, but the olive oil ice cream is just very pure and amazing. The other thing I've been doing lately with olive oil is frying eggs in them. So look this up if you're into like eggs in the morning, but have you done that?
Yeah.
You,
oh, so many times.
Yeah. That's like such a, I don't know. They just get like puffy.
And they
like,
get puffy and then they get this like super crispy edge. And we actually, in our website photography or photo shoot, we did fried eggs. So you can see them and you see that they're like super puffy and beautiful.
I don't know, maybe I'm not going to the right restaurants, but I came across this technique like online at one point, and I was like, I've never seen this before. And I started making it. It's just like one of the best ways to have eggs.
It's also a great substitute. You can substitute butter out when you're making brownies because it makes the brownies more moist and like really, really like soft. And yeah, it's really
wonderful.
I remember
making a pound cake a while back with avocados instead of butter, but I bet that would work well with olive oil.
With olive oil, yes.
Yeah.
An olive oil pound cake would be incredible. And actually the oil that you have, the lemon, it'll be really good because it'll have like a nice hint of lemon.
I'm looking at the bottle. This is one of the, this like the special lemon. Who's the artist?
So this is for our Lucid Lemon Oil that we launched in February of 2019. And we worked with an artist named Beattie Graft. And I had been following him since before Brightland launched. And so, and he was on like my mood board, you know, of like, oh my gosh, this is the kind of vibe that I'm going for with the brand. And so then I reached out and he said he had done work for some fashion designers and some furniture designers. And he was like, I've never done anything in food and I'd love to work together. And he just captured. So like, I think I sent him like a sample of the oil. And so he got to taste it. And then he just captured kind of the essence of, yeah, of Brightland plus what we were going for with Lucid so beautifully. And so now we're doing another one. Not with him, but with another artist.
It reminds me, a few episodes ago, we had the folks from Backdrop Home. They make home paint. Yeah, and we're just talking about, you know, how difficult it is to communicate color, you know, through the internet because it's not going to look exactly the same through your monitor.
Yeah.
But their names, they were talking about, you know, travel is a big inspiration and putting out Spotify playlists that kind of match the different moods of the colors and stuff.
Yeah.
And I think when you're talking about, you know, how do we marry art and like a feeling to a flavor,
yes.
You know, it goes into like synesthesia world, but what kind of music do you think of when you think of Brightland or how do you like
expand? Oh, I love that you asked me this because we have a Spotify persona and we come out with playlists
really?
Every month.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, we did. We do playlists almost every month for different things.
No
so
way.
We'll do like, yeah, like the Awake playlist and then we'll have like a cozy dinner playlist. And
that's great for dinner parties that make sense.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Let's see. So overall, the brand was really inspired by like Americana folk music. Yeah, I think like Fleetwood Mac is like a no-brainer. We love French pop. Let's see. There's an amazing folk artist named Justin Townes Earl. I think he really sums up Brightland's vibe when you're in the kitchen. Like that's what I would probably put on to kind of to cook and to use Brightland. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, it's just one of those things where I think with olive oil, I would definitely be more likely to give it a try because it's really hard to be disappointed almost in a good olive oil. But for other things, like you're going to paint your entire wall a certain shade, it might be a little more scary.
Yeah.
Is there a challenge there around selling products online like olive oil that you've tried to figure out how to, you know, get across what this product is going to be like?
Well, I think that's where whether it's our photography or the recipes that we talk about, the chefs or recipe developers who we bring on board to create recipes for us and the world that we're creating, that's our way to communicate with the outside world. And then ultimately, you know, of course, like having retail to kind of, our stores do tastings and people can go and experience it. So I think there's that piece of it. And then, you know, we've been asked a lot generally to taste test and for gifting, we've been asked a lot about minis. So that'll come.
Samples. I guess it seems more important.
And to travel with. People are like, oh I want to travel with Brightland.
I'm picturing like those little vodka bottles.
Yeah.
Those like
tiny we're definitely
little...
going to have like a baby Brightland.
Uh-huh. I could see that.
It's cute. It'll be cute.
Yeah. That's, I would bring that to, the office
Well, that's been really fun to hear that a lot of people have the bottles in their offices and like, you know, employees or the team just uses it or some people bring it as their personal bottle and they leave it on their desk.
Yeah.
So, cause they eat a salad every day and then they'll use Brightland as their olive oil for their salad.
Yeah. Maybe this makes me a snob, but our coffee at Lumi is like really good and it's just always, grind it every day and black pepper. I love black pepper personally. And I can't stand like, you know, pre-milled.
Yeah.
Like all of that kind of stuff where you just really want it fresh. And the difference between it fresh or not fresh is so vast, in my opinion. It's like, why are we even considering the alternative at all?
It's interesting. I mean, we live in this era where a lot of times I think people aren't really paying attention to what they're actually eating. Like, I think we live in this like wellness, like let's hack the food system, probiotic craze, like all of that stuff. And that's fine. But what about the simple, like just some really good veggies and some fruit and some olive oil and black pepper and high quality basics. You know, we're definitely in this like hyper complex kind of food scenario, and you know, the basics are really beautiful.
I'm shaking my head vehemently on it. It's just like all the best cooking, I mean, is just
it needs like a few ingredients,
a handful of great ingredients, and then that's it.
Yep. And for us, we want to be that olive oil in your home.
Yeah. You're talking about cauliflower. That's been a thing for me lately. I've been making a lot of cauliflower.
Ooh, what do you do with it?
Just roast it.
Yeah.
You know, like three ingredients, olive oil, cauliflower, salt, black pepper.
It's so outstanding.
Just put it in the oven, roast it. It's
and then you
the
can
best.
You can add it to anything. Like you can add it to Greek yogurt and then top it with some like crispy quinoa or crispy rice. Like you can turn it into some pretty magical stuff.
Have you gone back to your Indian heritage and brought olive oil into that? Because it's a common thing, by the way. Like a lot of Indian recipes, I don't know if this is just a modern thing, but it starts with olive oil. And I don't know if that's not a traditional way to do it. But.
I mean, what's been so exciting is that we actually did a photo shoot that celebrated Indian cuisine. So we did like chana masala and South Indian, you know, spicy potatoes and a few other things that featured Brightland, because I was like, I really want to shine a spotlight on my heritage and talk a little bit about kind of my relationship with Indian food and how kind of we've come full circle with this product now. And my parents, you know, we used olive oil in cooking, and we also use like, you know, a couple others like peanut oil, I think, and sesame oil. But now, you know, I think